Colm Tobin is one of Ireland's most beloved writers, three-time Man Booker nominee, multiple award winner. His novel Brooklyn was made into a movie that was Oscar nominated. He's won countless awards for his many works of fiction and non-fiction. And his latest book is The House of Names, which is the retelling of an ancient Greek tale. It's great to have you in the studio. Thank you, Colm.
Great.
Why this story? Why this particular Greek tale?
It's there. It's been there for thousands of years. It remains very powerful. What I discovered was that there's a late play by Euripides called Iphigenia in Aulis. And I'd never read that play. And that play tells the story from Clytemnestra's point of view. Now, Clytemnestra was the wife of Agamemnon. And he wanted the wind to change so he could go to the Trojan War and win it. In order to do that, he appealed to the gods. And the gods said, yes, we'll change the wind for you, but you must sacrifice your beautiful daughter, Iphigenia. So he called his wife and he called his daughter and he came with Orestes, who was the other brother, and said, okay, come for a wedding. He lured them. He fooled them. He told them, you're going to marry Achilles, who is the warrior, and we're going to have a wedding. So they got all the clothes ready. They got quite excited and they arrived. And even when he saw them, when he came first, he didn't have the courage to tell them what was really going to happen. He played sword fighting with Orestes, who was his young son he hadn't seen for a while. He held him in his arms. He kissed everybody. And it was just later when poor Clytemnestra was wandering around and saw Achilles and said to him, well, you know, it's marvelous that you're going to marry my daughter. And he said, marry your daughter? I'm not married. No, you are. You're the one. And he said to her, do you really not know what's going to happen? And she didn't. And then soon she did. And she did everything to stop it. And of course, she couldn't stop it. And when she couldn't stop it, she decided that what she would do would be she would wait until her husband returned victorious from the war, as he did. And she, in turn, would murder him. And of course, Electra, her daughter, was loyal to her father rather than her mother. So Electra decided, actually, I'm going to get you, my mother. So this violence is spiraling out of control. I mean, it's like any civil war. And when Orestes, the young brother, comes home, he's been away somewhere. No one knows where. There's no source for that. And Electra says, we have to get together and we have to kill our mother and our mother's lover. And you must do it.
The fact that you really humanized Clytemnestra, who had been vilified in many ways in previous versions of this as somebody who murdered her husband Agamemnon. I mean, you set the story up that she became unhinged because of the murder of her daughter. And you've done such a service, I think, to the inner complexity of women, and particularly women of a certain age, not in this book only, but in so many of your books, from Brooklyn to Nora Webster to the story about Mary, the mother of Jesus. You really do examine that complex inner life of a mother who has dealt with tragedy, whether it's the death of a spouse or the death of a daughter or the death of a child, another child. Was this something that you always want to examine? Is are mothers very important in your realm and in particularly in the writing that you do?
I think you see it in the ancient Greek plays, in Medea, in Electra, in Antigone, for example, that powerlessness. For example, in the in the New Testament, that Mary, the mother of Jesus, she doesn't have the power of her son. She doesn't speak much. Jesus is always speaking in parables, or he's a Sermon on the Mount, but his mother is mainly silent. Now, out of that silence, if you break that silence and you have her speak takes on a particular texture or a particular power. And I think this happens even in the most ordinary families, including mine indeed, that that a woman's life, because in general, it is not a life that has a lot of power. I mean, I'm talking about provincial Ireland in the late 1960s, where really there were no women in politics, there were no women in power. I mean, feminism was just beginning. But in a provincial place, feminists looked strange. I mean, even though in the novel, Nora Webster, she is a sort of feminist, she doesn't know she is. She sees them on the television and they're different from the person she thinks she is. But she has a very rich inner life. And it, all the richer, perhaps, because it is not allowed to express itself in the public realm. Therefore, its place in the private realm takes up a great deal of space. And I think you can work with that. For example, in my novel Brooklyn, Ailish Lacey goes to Brooklyn, but if she were a young man, she would get involved in sport, she'd be in a bar a lot. The streets would be his. You know, he would be able to walk home without any problem, see his friends, be out at the weekend. Whereas a young woman arriving in Brooklyn in the early 1950s, really, her bedroom is quite an important space for her. It's the only space she quite dominates. And also, she's very careful in everything she does and says. Clothes are very important for her. That's one thing they can all easily talk about. And so you get a sense of someone whose inner life is actually much richer than her outer life. And you can really work with that then, because she becomes someone filled with ambiguities, and that she's quite stubborn in some ways. She's really intelligent. She notices everything. But also, people like her, but she doesn't look in the mirror all the time or dress up all the time. So there are many things about her you can put into the book. And so I think there are novels. I mean, Jane Austen does it, Henry James does it, George Eliot did it. That whole idea, or say Alice Munro as a short story writer does it, where the lives of people who are not powerful tend to be the lives of women, and in those lives, with those lives, you can start working, and you can start showing what someone's really thinking. And then show what they're saying, and then show the vast difference, perhaps, between what they're thinking and saying. And that's very dramatic. It's much more dramatic in a way than someone who has full control over their lives or over their world, whether they be a king or indeed a man. That in either of those ways, you tend to get a sort of dryness, a close connection between doing and saying, which really doesn't leave you a lot of space if you're a novelist.
We're speaking with best-selling author Colm Tobin today on KGNU. His latest book is House of Names, and it's the retelling of an ancient Greek tale, The Ultimate Dysfunctional Family. King Agamemnon, his wife Clytemnestra, who ended up killing Agamemnon over the sacrifice of their daughter Iphigenia, and her sister Electra, the brother Eurystheus. We talked about the loss of faith that Clytemnestra had because Agamemnon sacrificed their daughter to appease the gods, and she is completely loses faith in this. Now, you have talked a lot about your own faith, your own Catholic faith growing up. And then, of course, you've written about the Mary, the Testament of Mary, the book that you wrote that has become a Broadway show. What is your relationship now to your faith and this theme of being let loose and being unleashed when you let go of a faith that has maybe been oppressive to someone?
It wasn't only that I was brought up within Catholicism, but that there were other beliefs older than Catholicism, pre-Christian ones, that were still current. And this might sound strange, because in a way they were so taken for granted. But where I'm from in Ireland, up to a certain year, it was believed that if someone in the family was going to die, that the banshee would appear. I mean, somebody from another realm would appear and make herself known, bang on the door, for example, or do something to let everyone know that death was coming. And people genuinely believed that. And I think there's a marvellous version of this story where W.B. Yeats, the poet, and Lady Gregory, they were collecting folklore and a lot of stories about fairies, you know, figures, supernatural figures in the landscape. And they asked a woman if she believed in them. Oh, the woman thought for a while, because she was, of course, a practicing Catholic. So she'd be very careful now. She said, oh, no, she said, I don't believe in them, but they're there. And I think that idea of having an older thing that was animism or paganism, and that Catholicism or Christianity, especially in Ireland, they came together very easily. So a holy hill in the west of Ireland, for example, Kirkpatrick, clearly was a pagan hill, and it was an important place of worship, and then it became an important Christian place of worship. And on the last Sunday in July, thousands and thousands of people walk up that hill. It's a sight to behold, because on one side you've got Clew Bay with a beautiful view, but that holy mountain is a Christian mountain, or is a Catholic mountain now, and was a pagan mountain. So living in that landscape, and then what happens is the arrival into Ireland of, you know, a sort of anti-spirituality, of a sort of response to Catholicism, which is that a lot of people just stop going to Mass on Sunday. When I was growing up, the church where I'm from, in Enniscorthy, in the southeast of Ireland, I mean, it was full from 7 o'clock Mass on a Sunday in the morning, on 12 o'clock Mass, with Mass on every hour. The idea of a Mass on a Saturday night before Sunday was unheard of. I always think that was the beginning of the end, having a Mass on a Saturday night. But everyone going up to communion and everyone bowing their heads. And well, it's not like that now. I mean, fewer and fewer people actually go. And also, when I was growing up, you would be asked, were you thinking of becoming a priest? And people in my class became priests. Whereas now there are very, very few vocations. A lot of priests and nuns really are old now. And it looks as though something really did change in the society. Now, it may not be the actual bedrock of faith. We'll be careful about that. But certainly the ways of worship have dwindled.
And certainly the presence of the Catholic Church as an institution.
Yes, it certainly dwindled. But if you go even on Good Friday now, where the shops are open, everyone's buying everything. People are coming out of supermarkets or out of, you know, they're going DIY shops on a Good Friday. When I was a kid, if you went outside your door, a woman would come over and say, go back in home. You shouldn't even be out playing on a Good Friday.
Well, up until this year, it was illegal to sell alcohol on Good Friday. And hence, it became such a hot point for house parties. You'd stock up on Holy Thursday.
I mean, people
for your
really
part
would
Good Friday.
Do that.
And there was a law, but I think that just got changed just this year.
Yeah, it just got changed this year. Oh, up to then, that Good Friday, there were 2 days of the year in Ireland completely dry, were Christmas Day and Good Friday. People would go nuts, and they would, as you say, have house parties.
You'd be on the hunt for
and
a
you'd
party.
You'd see people the day before fast, as though they were going to drink Dublin dry on that day. So there has been a huge change in Ireland. And in a way, I was trying to register that in this book, House of Names, to get the idea that they lived in a world where people believed in the gods, as I lived in a world, and you must have too, where people would pray to Mary, or people would believe in miracles, or go to Lourdes looking for cures, and then where people didn't believe in that as much anymore. And so I'm reflecting that in this book.
I'd like to also talk about one of the characters, the son, Orestes, and he is just, you fill in the gaps, as you say, you know, in the original telling of the tale. He just is gone and then he reappears as a young man, but you actually fill in the gaps of that. And of course, he's so impacted by the murder of his father, and then he ultimately murders his mother. Now, your own father died at you were quite young. You were 12.
Yeah, my father died when I was 12. And I am, you know, a younger, there were three older than me. And I think it's quite important. If I were a psychiatrist, it's the first question I'd ask somebody who came in to see me. Where do you come in a family? Because I think the younger one is always feels that people could boss you around more than if you're the older one. I mean, I think that's quite an important thing. I don't hear much about it. So Orestes is very much the little boy. And his sisters, but now his sister Electra really is the older sister, and she's filled with power. I mean, she really, really knows what she wants, and under pressure, she becomes quite a scheming figure. I mean, she has strategies. Orestes never has strategies. He just moves from day to day, and it could be, you know, in an ordinary life, it could be one of those guys who's immensely competent, does what he does, everyone likes him, and no one ever puts any pressure on him. But of course, this is ancient Greece, and he is from a royal family, and immense pressure is put on him. He witnesses the sacrificing of his sister. He's kidnapped, and when he comes back, his mother really loves him, his sister loves him, but they both also want him to do various things. And, you know, under those pressures, he really is ready to buckle. I mean, he's not tough. He's not strategic. And I think we all know somebody like that who's quite pleasant, quite easygoing. But if there's a big row at work, you find someone who just doesn't know what to do. He's on both sides, and he's really easy to manipulate in that way. I think there are a lot of more people like that in the world than we'd all like to admit.
Well, do you think because of the loss of a father figure, the loss of his father, that that influenced that? And you know, what was your own experience?
Yes, I think, my own experience was that I think when that happens in a family, you're unmoored, that there's no anchor, and that you don't know. What happens with parents is they don't know how much to talk about it or how little to talk about it. And so a sort of silence descends and you try and deal with it as best you can on your own. I think it might be useful if you're a novelist in a way, because you get a sense very early on of the distance between sometimes what people are feeling and what they're saying. That I realised that at home people were thinking about my father who had died, but they were trying to change the subject and think about something else. And also ordinary life has a way of washing over things. So you go back to school. So, you know, people start thinking about your studies. So Christmas comes and time moves on. And you realise that you think about the person who's passed, you know, in waves. It comes in moments. And I use that in the novel Nora Webster. It would come in certain moments to her. In others, she'd try and not think about it. And it was the same with the children. So I was putting some of that into the figure of Orestes in this novel, House of Names, that, you know, his father went to war. He didn't see his father. And he's always trying to imagine his father. He begins a sword fight, thinking that he sort of is his father. He's that sort of little boy. And then, of course, he's kidnapped. But before that, he witnesses his sister being sacrificed. So this trauma has happened to him. So, you know, before he's at 10 or 11, quite a lot of things have happened to him. You know, enough for you to realise that actually by the time he gets home when he's about 20, he's quite a damaged little fellow and he will do anything under pressure. And there are so many pressures.
Do you think we're teaching the classics now? And I ask this now because you've also, in addition to being a writer, you've moved into a realm of third level education because you've recently been appointed Chancellor of the University of Liverpool. You've been Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Manchester, a visiting professor at several US colleges, including Princeton and Stanford. And you're currently Professor of Humanities at Columbia University in New York. Do people learn the classics now? Did you learn them when you were growing up? Do people have an awareness of this?
I did Latin. And I came just at the end of Greek. And I missed that because it would have been great. I mean, I know people went on to do a thing called Greek and Roman Civilization. But I think it's vital for anyone who's going to study literature to have a grounding in these Greek plays. I noticed, for example, how much Shakespeare took for Hamlet or even for Macbeth or even for Coriolanus from these Greek texts. In other words, Hamlet is a boy who's... father has been murdered, whose mother has taken a lover. Well, I know where he got that. And so you can begin to connect things. You can begin to see a sort of root or a sort of story before all stories, which are these Greek stories. Certainly where I teach at Columbia, there's a thing called the core curriculum where when students arrive in the university, they read all the great books. So, you know, I'm trying to teach, say, Irish mythology. But there are students coming into me who, on the same day, been reading Greek mythology, and they're able to connect the two.
You connect the two in this book. You mentioned the children of
Fair. I connect the two in this book, but I'm talking about students. I'm talking about undergraduates who get such a grounding in great works. I mean, they're reading Dante, they're reading Homer, so that grounding seems to be an essential part of anyone's education. And I'm really proud of the fact that it still exists at Columbia.
Are you concerned at all about the state of third level education, whether it's funding, whether it's who has access to this now?
I'm not concerned about it in one way, in that I get students that are so brilliant, that are so ready to work, that are so dedicated. It's not as though they come in with their privilege, you know, saying, I can laze around for a few years. They come in completely dedicated. But on the other hand, you really worry in America about the fees. They just seem to me so high. When I heard about them first, I honestly thought it was a piece of fake news, that you could pay that amount of money per year to get an education. which where we're from in Ireland, is more or less free, that if you're good enough, you get into a university. If you're not good enough, you don't. So you study hard, but it's not about how much money your parents make. So people really who are quite poor in Ireland, if they had a child who was talented, could really push the child to say, look, if you study, you can go to the best university in Ireland, and you can be a doctor, an engineer, or you can be, you can be a poet or a writer, you can be anyone you want to be, whether you're a boy or a girl. That sort of idea is there. It doesn't always work because sometimes the high schools are, there are sort of differences of opportunity. If you go to a very good school when you're 12, you have a much better chance of getting in to a big university. But the opportunity is theoretically there for everybody. And I think it's something that really America has to think about seriously.
We're speaking with best-selling author Colm Tobin today on KGNU. His latest book is House of Names, and it's the retelling of an ancient Greek tale. King Agamemnon, his wife Clytemnestra, who ended up killing Agamemnon over the sacrifice of their daughter Iphigenia, and her sister Electra, the brother Eurystheus. Well, this book, despite all the blood and the gore and the familial drama and the murders and the death, there's kind of an uplifting ending because there's a self-consciousness or some type of self-awareness on the remaining characters that the cycle must be broken, and there's the possibility of a new baby coming in and a new generation, and there does seem to be that self-awareness, which seemed to be a break from the traditional Greek telling of the story. You don't often get the happy endings. Was it something, though, you felt that I should lighten the mood here just a little bit, or offer some type of hope?
Well, even at the end of the Oresteia, there is a sense of the jury system put in place. That the state of Athens is about to begin, and we're about to get a sort of modern government. So I wanted some sense of that with the way Leander and Electra are beginning to sort of run the country. But Orestes is lonelier than ever. And I mean, even though there's a new baby being born, Orestes still has in his mind there are a few other people he'd like to kill. He'd like to kill Aegisthus still, and he probably will after this book is ended. So I didn't want a golden ending. But yes, some cycle has been completed, and it is as though this is the beginning of a time when there will be a sort of, the elders are being brought in more, where there's a sense of not government by dictator, but a sort of different system of government. And so at the very end of the book, I suppose there's an image of that, but also with the new baby being born, and with all of them sort of feeling that they're exhausted. And so many people have been now killed that perhaps for one, that something may end, but it's not complete. Because I feel that Orestes has a few more people in his crosshairs, yeah.
Well, you've had some of your previous work turned into different mediums. I mean, you've had Brooklyn turn into major, major Hollywood movie. The Testament of Mary, that retelling of Mary's story and her grief after the crucifixion of Jesus, that was then a Broadway play. What happens to you as the creator of these works when you see them transformed in the hands of others into a completely different medium?
I mean, it's really fascinating, and there's no downside to it, especially working or even if I don't get to work with, but get to see doing the work, actresses like Fiona Shaw, or for example, the audiobook of The Testament of Mary is done by Meryl Streep. And it was amazing to hear what she did with her voice, as it was with Fiona Shaw on Broadway. And at the moment it's on in Paris in the Odeon. It opened 2 days before the election. And it was funny to see the big crowd of French people coming in just to go somewhere away from the politics with a great French actress called Dominique Blanc. And then, of course, Saoirse Ronan, who played the part in Brooklyn, who really put so much into it because it was the first Irish part she'd played. She's from near where I'm from in Ireland, and she played everything. She played the lovely Bones, Atonement, the Grand Hotel Budapest. She had been a child actress, and she was looking for a good Irish, a thing that would matter to her if she played it as an Irish character. And I was proud that, this book was there for her and that she put so much into it. And So seeing these actors work and the amount of dedication they do is just so unexpected. I mean, I just thought I was going to, if I was lucky, get to publish some books. But this is a great extra, and there's no downside.
You did get some blowback for the Testament of Mary from conservative Christian groups, Catholic organisations, who thought it was blasphemous to imagine what Mary might have said. I mean, tell us a little bit about the reaction. I think a lot of that was from the US.
Yeah, there was none in Ireland. It was played by Marie Mullen in Ireland, and there was none. And there was none in Spain, and there was none in Mexico.
The very only traditional place, Catholic countries.
Yeah, traditional Catholic countries. But in the United States, I think identity politics are really important, that everybody comes not only with their own name, but a sense of them being one thing, whether that one thing is conservative, whether that one thing is liberal, whether that one thing is Democrat or Republican, whether it was gay, straight. You know, everybody has an identity in America. And what we're looking at in America, in a way, is a whole set of identity wars going on, which make their way into elections, which doesn't happen in the same way in other countries. And it's lovely if your identity wins, and it's not nice if your identity doesn't win. And but yeah, it was surprising on the first preview night and on the opening night when people began to appear outside the theatre whistling and shouting and at statues. And, you know, I was very serious when I wrote The Testament of Mary. I wasn't involved in mockery. I was trying to explore something quite important, which is that if you have a figure who is mainly silent, and if that figure was a woman, and if her son was crucified, what did she feel like? What was that like for her at the time? We have so many images of her. The iconography is extensive, but the actual speech isn't. And once you think about that, you think, well, that in a way is what the theatre is for, or that's what the novel form is for. I mean, that's what literature is for, to begin to imagine figures who up to then people had not imagined in full. And I was doing that. But yeah, there were people wrote me very unpleasant emails and letters, and it was quite a time.
Colm Tobin, author of The House of Names, thank you so much.
Thank you.